now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and this week I'm joined by Mr. Oliver Kay, Mr. Patty Barkley, and from way up north of the border, Mr. Graham Spears. Today we'll be discussing Arsenal's win at Aston Villa, the comeback by Spurs against Liverpool, and also we'll be asking what's going on with referees in Scotland, as well as dipping our little toes into the World Cup bidding pool. All right, let's kick things off with Spurs and Liverpool. I want to start with something before we talk about the game. I just wondered, does David Ngog own a television? And if so, did he see what happened last week with that Raphael van der Vaart free kick? Because it seems to me absurd that if you've seen that last week, why would you jump like that again with your hands protecting your face and give away a pretty silly penalty? Let's ask Ollie, since he lives closest to David Ngog than any of us.
First of all, I think conceding a penalty against Tottenham is not necessarily a dangerous tactic. I mean, it just means that you get a goal kick or that you gain possession soon afterwards. So, Jermaine Defoe continuing their wonderful record from the penalty spot this season. But he was absolutely stupid. I cannot understand why Ngog would stick his hands out in that way and stop the ball. It's just inexplicable. It just, it reminds me of that old Dave Bassett quote about footballers having the brains of a rocking horse.
Graham, this kind of stuff, it seems that like we've seen it happen for sort of 20, 30 years. Although I remember when I was a little kid, it was more footballers putting their hands down in front of their private parts, and yeah. Now they want to go and protect their face, maybe for commercial reasons. Do you see this north of the border, or is it just a Ponzi English thing?
No, you see it in the SPL. I mean, in my experience, I've seen footballers do all sorts of inexplicable things which cannot be explained afterwards. Sometimes raising the arm is a kind of instinctive thing where they don't really think about it. But the thing that amazes me is when players do such a thing and then vehemently complain about it as if it's against the rules. The amount of players and sometimes even managers who aren't familiar with rules regarding handball and penalty or free kick. So I'm the same as Ollie. I see it quite a lot. And players complain about it as if they don't appreciate the laws of the game. It's amazing.
Scott, Andy Gray, Patty, made the point last night that given what footballers earn,
yes,
you know, getting hit in the face by a free kick, you know, they should put up with that.
Absolutely. But where it's all gone wrong, of course, it's since they start getting paid in image rights. That's why they now raise their hands to protect the countenances. Instead of the more substantial parts that lie south of the belt. But the stupidity of footballers never, ever ceases to amaze me. The way they are drawn to the crowd, even though they're expressly told that you can't go into the crowd for fear of a yellow card. The way they remove their shirts, although they're expressly told that you can't remove your shirt for fear of a yellow card. Which makes you wonder if a footballers aren't constantly at the what might be called the Mourinho trick of getting yourself booked deliberately. It is extraordinary that, as you say, that the Ngog incident should happen so soon after the After the Fabregas one. I mean, who would have thought Fabregas would be a stupid footballer? Of all the footballers in Britain, if you arranged them in a list of who of a likelihood to be a stupid footballer, Fabregas, I would have thought, would have come at the bottom. And yet,
are we sure it was Fabregas last week? And not
might have been Nasri. Yeah. Well, okay, well, he'd have been second last.
And to be fair, Fabregas was jumping with his...
he was jumping with his arms up.
I want to just take a quick look at Jermaine Defoe because, of course, he missed a penalty. I'm just wondering, now when he's fit again, where does he fit into this Spurs team? Given
as one of three-stroke four strikers, I mean they.
So he fits on the bench, basically.
No, he plays in some games and not in others. You know, and there will be certain games in which they want size and power up front, and they'll play Crouch and Pavlyuchenko. There'll be other games.
So two strikers then.
In which sometimes they'll play with two strikers, sometimes they'll play with one and one. In other words, if there will be certain games. I reckon against top four sides where Tottenham will play with one striker and a Van der Vaart. That way you can give you a better balance in the team. There will be other games where they play with Crouch and Defoe. There'll be other games where they play with Crouch and Pavlyuchenko. I mean, I think that is the way that...
It does seem kind of curious. I want to throw this out to you guys, Graham and Ollie, as well, though, because it seems to me most top teams today, not just in England, but I think across Europe, you know, they'll have big squads, but they generally have a hierarchy, or at least when it comes to strikers, a sense that, you know, if it's United, it's Berbatov and Rooney. If it's Chelsea, it's Drogba, Anelka, and Malouda. And you can extend that out to Barcelona or Inter Milan or Real Madrid. It's a bit of an unusual approach to have to change your strikers and your midfield sort of constantly and change the formation as well, isn't it, Wally?
I don't think it's that unusual at all. I think Harry Redknapp has got, I would say, the best options below his first 11, whatever that first 11 may be. I would say his options from the bench are better than those of any of his fellow managers. I would say Alex Ferguson hardly ever picks a settled team. He changes all over the pitch from one game to the next. It's common to make five or six changes from one game to the next. Tottenham haven't historically had the need to do that because they've not really been in Europe and not really, well, certainly not in the Champions League. But they need a variety, they need a quality and a quantity in their options, particularly up front. Defoe's been out for whatever it is, nearly 3 months with an injury. Van der Vaart is now out. People drop in and out. They need cover. And I would say, of all the managers in the Premier League, I don't think anybody has got better options up front than Harry Redknapp.
It's funny because, you see, this is what gets me about tons of points I'm trying to make is there's so much. I mean, I think it's tremendous that they've achieved what they've achieved because, as my information, I spoke to a Tottenham coach a couple of weeks ago, and he said there's no question that the only striker that we should be playing one up to accommodate Van der Vaart, and there's no question that the only striker here who can play as a lone striker because Defoe is too small and too lazy and Crouch, you know, is a different sort of player. The only guy who can do it is Pavlyuchenko, but you have to kind of coax and prod him into working for the team and keeping him interested. Graham, let's move on and talk about something happy, which is Liverpool's 4-4-2, which I find remarkable because obviously with Gerrard out, you know, you have to try something different. In this case, he goes and changes the whole formation to a 4-4-2, which you saw last week and this week in Gog and Torres. Just philosophically, what do you make of that, of a team changing its formation when its big star goes out?
I don't mind. It's kind of linked to the last question about consistency of selection. I don't mind managers playing one up, two up, playing 4-2-3-1 or mixing their systems. But when you mention 4-4-2 and Liverpool, I immediately think of Craig Levein and this recent tactical fuss that was triggered by Levein when he said playing two strikers up top is definitely on the way out. And Levein thinks in one or two or 3 years or 4 years you'll never see it at all, which I disagree with. I mean, when I look around the EPL and games in Scotland, I see plenty teams playing with two up. But Levein thinks it's a form of football suicide now to play two strikers. But in terms of Roy Hodgson, or Alex Ferguson or anyone else, I do not see at all why they shouldn't change their shapes week by week. Where I do have a beef with is what you were talking about previously when you talk about teams changing strikers. I mean, I was steeped in a football tradition where clubs had an iconic striker, a striker that would be there, the main focal point of the team, and it seems to me that a team like Spurs right now don't have that. But different systems for different games is fine by me.
Moving on to Villa and Arsenal. Arsenal talk about a team where, you know, I think there has been an evolution system-wise from a 4-4-2, of course, over the years. Now it's more of a 4-3-3. But what I think has been really impressive this year, and I certainly had my doubts when he was signed, but he's been fantastic, is Marouane Chamakh. Yes. We knew he was hardworking. He puts a team first. You can also, you know, hit it long to his head if you want, and he'll take care of the ball. But he's also scoring goals, Paddy. And
yes.
Where does he rank among among the summer's best signings, the Premier League's best?
Very, very highly, in my opinion. I mean, Arsenal have had a problem with a classical centre forward. They're so good at working the ball wide, and then after that they have to work it back and inside again. I mean, this has given them a new dimension. In fact, they've improved the team greatly this season, and in a couple of positions, and the ability now, the variety that he gives them in the way that you've just described, has taken them really far forward. The only problem is that if only Wenger had sorted out his central defensive problems more convincingly in the summer, I think Arsenal would be the favourites for the league title, and Chamakh would obviously be a principal reason for that. I think he's been absolutely marvellous. And considering this is his first season in the English game, he's lived up to every expectation. They can get rid of Bentner now safely.
And Van Persie can get rid of himself. He keeps getting hurt.
Well, I think when this is always the problem with Van Persie. When he plays, he's fine. When he plays his way back in, he's fine, which he's been trying to do recently. The main thing is that Arsenal have got a centre forward and a new dimension. I think he's been I would put him up with Van der Vaart as the best new entrant to the Premier League.
Ollie, I never thought I'd say this of a Gerard Houllier team, but are Villa playing actually better than their results?
I think it's easy to look at Villa's performances in a more positive light because they've got so many young players and so many of the performances of the young players, Bannon, Albrighton, Clark, etc., have been encouraging. But they no longer look like the team they looked like under O'Neill, which was always going to punch its weight, always going to threatened to get results, and probably until about March when the lack of rotation meant that they got tired. But they just look like a young, naive team. And I think that is the worry, because Houllier just seems to be accepting that and making excuses for it and explaining. There's that whole thing of managing expectations. I think he's revised or altered people's perceptions and expectations of Villa very, very quickly, and I can see what he's trying to do in terms of what they do on the pitch. But yes, they're probably playing better, but they're not playing well enough to make you think they're going to be a 6th, 7th, 8th team like they probably should be.
No, I think they're getting the results that play deserves. Of course, they should have had a crushing victory over Manchester United, but they didn't let that happen. The young players are very good. The style of football is, to my taste, improved, but I don't think they're playing particularly well at all. The main problem, I think, is that they've given a new position to Ashley Young. They're playing him in the hole behind, off the front, which throws a lot of onus on the player's ingenuity and tactical nous, and Ashley Young has virtually none.
It's not something he can learn. I mean, he's still a young player.
No, there's no chance. I mean, that's my assessment of him. I think that Martin O'Neill understood what to do. Use his pace on the break. Use him on the left-hand side with a whipped ball in. With the right foot, which is a horrible, you know, every defender hates that, and Young was good at that.
But then he sang Downing, though.
But there's not an awful exactly.
I assume
what he wanted to do was the left foot are on the right and the right foot are on the left, which is fine if they're Messi and Ronaldinho. Maybe right. Not so good if they're Downing and. Or even Adam Johnson and whoever England tried last time, Ashley Young. So it's one of these fashions that doesn't always work. It depends on the players. But I just think that Ullier should drop that idea. It was worth a try, but it hasn't worked.
Graham, I'm going to play. I can't believe I'm doing this. I'm going to pretend I'm Gerard Houllier's lawyer here, or advocate, mm-hmm. as you might say in Scotland, and say, okay. Well, let's talk about this realistically. I missed preseason when I came in. I have a goalkeeper who's 100 years old and looks like he belongs in a coffin. I've got
jolly
my
good though.
What? Yes, in 1998, I have a right back. Carlos Cuellar is hurt. Stylian Petrov, funnily enough, now that Martin's gone, he seems to get hurt all the time. I've got a whole bunch of players here who didn't like Martin O'Neill, and another bunch of players who love Martin O'Neill and who hate me because I'm Gerard Houllier. I've got John Carew, who's going out of contract and is all sulky. I've got this Stephen Ireland creature landed here. And I have no idea what to do with him. I understand Martin didn't like him either, and I don't like him, certainly, and I don't know what to do with this.
And yet he can play.
He can play a little bit, theoretically. I'm playing the kids, Bannon, Albrighton, these guys did so well in the FA Youth Cup. What's wrong with that? Martin, we're going to get a look at under Martin, and also I'm playing the kids because, let's face it, when a manager plays the kids and he loses, he doesn't get criticized as much. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think if you wanted to be fair to Gerard Houllier, you would say any new manager coming into a team like Villa deserves a chance to at least recreate the team in his own image. And a football team in the image of Houllier would certainly be, I think we'd all agree on this, be drastically different from Martin O'Neill. Martin O'Neill liked a degree of muscular football. I saw it at Celtic. We've seen it at Villa. And I think what Martin O'Neill did have, which Houllier doesn't have, is Martin O'Neill could lift the emotional temperature of a team.
That's right.
He could somehow make a team emotionally charged up. I remember Celtic Henrik Larsson saying to me that when you left the dressing room after listening to Martin O'Neill, my God, you wanted to go out there and win at all costs. I don't think Houllier has got that spark. And I have to admit, I'm a bit of a Houllier cynic. I think his time has been and gone. Yes, give him a chance to recreate his own team, but I just think he, in the old disparaging phrase, he's a bit of a yesterday's man in football, and Villa
What about a gamble on him. What about your fellow Scott Gary Mack? Surely he can lift the spirits and miss penalties?
Yes, exactly, yeah. Although, the famous penalty you missed at Wembley, Gab, I think you'll agree with me that the wind made the ball move on the spot just before he struck
For the record, I'm joking. I joked with
yes,
him a lot.
Yes,
I actually
I
really
joking,
like
yeah.
Gary McAllister. He's actually one. No, I really do. I'm not joking. I think he's one of the bright guys and one of the good guys in the game. Okay, well, next week's question is who did more to derail the history of Scottish footballing success, Gary McAllister or Alan Hansen when he messed up the great Willie Miller? But we won't go back to that. How about we move on to our debate? And we're going to start with a story north of the border. Graham, I'm going to try to sum this up in 30 seconds, and I know I'll miss things, and I know that people will then write in and say, you didn't mention this about Doogie McDonald and blah, blah, blah. But it is a long story, and we do have limited time, so I'm going to crack on. Basically, and you tell me if I'm wrong here. Basically, a few weeks ago, in a match involving Celtic, the referee, Doogie McDonald, awarded a penalty, then changed his mind about it, and he did speak to the linesman at one point. He said that he told Neil Lennon after the match that the linesman told him that that he'd got it wrong with a penalty call. The linesman later they denied it and gave a slightly different version, and effectively looked as if Dougie MacDonald basically misrepresented the truth. And several clubs have asked that Dougie MacDonald resign. This whole thing then snowballed into a whole us versus them of the... this whole thing snowballed in an us versus them thing with referees. The Celtic chairman gave a speech at the Celtic AGM where he complained about the referees, where he asked for a full reform. The referees didn't like that, also because some of them were getting were supposedly getting death threats and abuse. Some referees, of course, in Scotland, they're all amateurs. They're getting calls that their employers were getting called, and people were they were creating trouble for them at work. Then there's a whole other story about Hugh Dallas and the Pope, which we don't have time for. But basically, long and short of it, referees decide to go on strike. Am I right so far?
The whole thing was triggered, as you said, by the fatal Dougie MacDonald botch up at Tannadice about 6 weeks ago between Dundee United and Celtic. Dougie MacDonald concocted this trifling fib between him and his linesman about why he made the decision. Fine, if it had stayed at that, fine. But half an hour after the game, Neil Lennon, the Celtic manager, walked into the referee's room and said, what happened there? And Dougie MacDonald fatally passed on the fib or the lie or whatever you want to call it to Neil Lennon. Celtic can now say, the SFA have lied to us. We've been lied to, however trifling it was, and we don't trust the SFA.
Why did he lie? Why didn't he just say?
Like, well, it's as you said, Gab, it's too long to go into, but the linesman actually got into a panic about why they changed their mind on the refereeing decision. The linesman was worried about what the referee's supervisor in the stand might think, so they concocted this trifling fib. But the point was, they crossed the Rubicon when they passed the lie on to Lennon and Celtic. Now, there have been, you probably know this, you guys will know this, there have been years, decades of bad blood between Celtic and the SFA, where Celtic, in some respects, the immigrant club of Scotland, have felt prejudiced against. And now Celtic officials, their supporters, are saying, this is our big moment. We are going to beat the SFA with a stick over this. Hugh Dallas has resigned. Celtic wanted his head. Dougie MacDonald, the referee, last night resigned. If you go to Celtic Park this morning, you'll see the heads of Hugh Dallas and Dougie MacDonald on top of spikes outside the stadium with Celtic fans cheering. So there's been
not
a
the
whole
real heads,
saga
I want to stress here, right? They're not, it's not their actual. Their actual. I just I never know.
Being,
with Scotland.
I wasn't being literal, no.
Right. Okay.
But there's been this bad blood, and this also led to the referees taking industrial action. So it's been a saga from start to finish.
All right. For those who missed this point this weekend, with the industrial action, the SFA and decided that the games are going to go again.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Go ahead. Anyway, they decided to call in referees from elsewhere. I don't think they've sort of thought this through particularly well, because I think most referees wouldn't want to be scabs, which is effectively what these people were. So they tried people from Norway, from Poland, from Portugal, from Ireland, from Iceland. I'm going to miss out countries. They asked everybody and their mother. In the end, they had to scratch the bottom of the barrel. They got two guys from Malta, one a Category 4 referee, Mr. Borg and Mr. Lottier, two guys from Israel, Mr. Levy, another Category 3 referee. For those who don't know, that's the lowest category of referee that where you're allowed to referee internationally, and somebody named Eli Hachman, who isn't even allowed to referee internationally. And then they got the wonderful Alan Hammer, who is from Luxembourg. He is an elite level referee. He's a very good referee. He's also retiring in 3 or 4 weeks. And well, as I seen, as I wrote last week, these sort of scabs hoard them out for their £800 match fee, basically. But I was just kind of wondering, this is obviously a one-off that they can't really do again, because it is kind of a freak show when you've got referees like this, right, Paddy?
Well, I don't necessarily say that they can't go on strike again. I wish the English referees had supported them. I would love a referee strike. I think we're at a fundamental point in terms of respect for officials. I think that a lot of civilized people will have sympathy with referees, and you know, you've got to come down on one side, and I would certainly like to say that I'm very much on the referees' side in anything they did. I wouldn't care if they went on strike for the whole rest of the season in England, Scotland, and throughout the world, to make the point that the level of abuse given to referees and people in public life these days is beyond acceptance. It's totally unacceptable and often criminal.
Ollie, are you with Paddy and the referees, or do you side with Matthew Syed, for example, who argues that referees should sort of suck it up and get on with it?
Well, I think Matthew's column last week was based on the idea that this was just normal abuse, and, yeah, and that, you know, it's part of the game, and referees should get on with it. Whereas, first of all, it's not normal abuse by sporting standards anyway. But secondly, it is a pretty extreme case, and it's a case where, it looks like the whole thing has reached a tipping point, really, in terms of football's relationship with its referees, certainly in Scotland. And I hope certain lessons are learned, really, because I think there have been big mistakes on both sides. I think the whole relationship needs evaluating. But I was disappointed to see referees crossing the picket line, the proverbial picket line, at least. I would think that referees should notice, you know, should note what was happening there, note that it was a, you know, that their brethren were making a stand and not cross the line. I just thought that was staggering. You'd think the refereeing fraternity would be closer together than that.
I can tell you this, Ollie, just the early indications coming out of Geneva and the refereeing folks there is, don't expect Mr. Hammer to turn up on any UEFA committee once he retires, despite the fact that he was an elite-level referee. And as for Mr. Borg, Mr. Lottier, Mr. Hackman, and Mr. Levy, I don't think you're going to be seeing those guys doing any match of any importance for a while.
No, I think
that was part of this general farce. I mean, these incoming referees, everybody agrees, they shouldn't have been coming into work because there was industrial action going on in Scotland. But the farcical nature of it was, these guys coming from abroad were uninformed about what was happening. They didn't realise it was industrial action. Yeah. For example, officials arrived from Portugal. They came to Glasgow Airport. You would have thought they might have boned up on what they were doing before they left.
Yeah.
They came to Glasgow Airport and the Scots ref said, "Guys, do you know what we're doing here?" Mm. And they didn't even leave the airport. They turned around and flew home again.
So in other words, the white lie or lie of omission told by the SFA cost Scottish football a lot of money in terms of wasted expenses. And I don't think the SFA have come out of it well. I'd just like to endorse what Graham said earlier about the historical background to this. And in fairness to Celtic, and because Celtic's attitude, I mean, Graham was described it beautifully, the way the righteous indignation of this club that's been downtrodden for years. There was an element of truth in that, just as there was, which mirrors the seeds of the conflict in Northern Ireland. There was generally a Protestant superiority in various forms of authority, which existed in the 60s and the 50s and before then. It doesn't exist anymore. However, the lingering resentment of that is still felt in the otherwise absolutely admirable psychology of Celtic Football Club, one of my favourite clubs, I might say, but to pretend that they don't have an inferiority complex and a victimology culture would be myopic. I've been interested, intimately interested in football for more than 50 years, and in all of that time, not one month has ever gone by in which somebody doesn't say, wouldn't it be nice if football officials and players had the a similar sort of relationship to rugby ones? Not a month in those 50 years has gone by without people saying that, and with a majority of decent, right-thinking people chorusing agreement.
The problem with that, Paddy, is that
are we
for most of those 50 years...
Do we not mean it, or are we just, chorusing agreement?
I disagree. Okay, I played rugby to a certain level. First of all, for the majority of those 50 years, rugby was an amateur sport, okay? So it was a completely different kettle of fish in many ways.
Are you implying that golf is not a professional sport? It's played to proper standards.
Golf doesn't have referees.
There is only one sport on earth that's played that is accompanied by the kind of vicious abuse that football shows for its officials.
I agree.
I
might suggest that rugby is also a bit different because, frankly, and if you've played rugby, you'll know this.
I have played rugby.
Okay, then you'll know this.
It was a privilege.
The referee gets maybe like 1% of what actually goes on, especially in the modern game.
Correct.
He calls penalties. He doesn't have to explain them. None of the facts. No. Why'd you call a penalty there? Well, I don't know. I could have called it 50 times.
He
could be flipping a coin for 50 times.
I agree rugby referees aren't particularly wonderful. But the point is they'd be an awful lot worse if 16 players were emerging from each scrum
I think there's a different expectation when you play rugby. There's a different expectation
and I'm saying
of the accuracy.
That expectations should change.
But that's fine.
Say,
but football's not rugby. Football's
right,
important.
Football.
Football has a different level of importance culturally and socially around
the
world.
Exactly, and that's why it should be above reproach.
Okay, well then, I guess these are the two options. Then either we have a different attitude, a more rugby attitude towards refereeing mistakes, like Paddy suggests, or I'm going to throw out my own idea here, and y'all can weigh in before we wrap this up, which is actually to have more scrutiny and more accountability of referees, but to do it in a different way, to accept the fact that the referees are, certainly in some leagues of professional they're not in Scotland, but that they're competing against each other.
Yes, we can have and more scrutiny and more respect together.
What I would like to see, precisely because we have that, I would like to see the people who evaluate the referees, and they exist, on the part of the SFA in this case, or whoever it is, and go out and make the reports public at the end of the game.
Absolutely.
Say, this guy did this, he got that wrong. Have your league publish your league tables of referees and let us all accept that these people are human and some are better than others.
Yes.
Rather than this blanket protection of referees and blanket accusation of referees. Ollie, are you with me?
No, completely.
Of course not.
I think it undermines their authority
not.
And brings an unnecessary element of pantomime to an already pantomime existence.
Yes, live on your knees. Graham, do you agree with Paddy and Ollie, or do you think that that players should show less respect?
I don't know if this is called sitting on the fence, but I agreed with Paddy's original point that probably some of the venom and the fervour has to be taken out of football. Footballers' aggression towards a referee has to be reined in. Having said that, one of the things I love about football is its visceral atmosphere. I don't want to live in a Mary Poppins universe where everything is purified. The only thing I would add about this refereeing saga in Scotland is, and this is different from what you guys see down south, we are talking here about the west of Scotland. There's a sectarian undercurrent beneath all of this, and in the cranky internet age, all of that is blown up, and referees are being threatened and receiving private abuse. So that is an important factor which has triggered this situation in Scotland.
There's obviously also cultural and historical reasons behind it, and maybe you can't come up with sort of a one-size-fits-all policy to solve this. And I like to think we're mature enough for transparency and accountability. Others, like Ollie Kay, want to keep it shrouded in mystery so the rich can stay rich and the privileged can maintain their privilege. So we're going to take a quick look at 2018-2022 World Cup bidding. The decision will be made on later this week. There's 2 days of presentations. I want to throw out some basic themes here that we can maybe hit very quickly. One is Do we believe that a lot of this media stuff that goes on, this is what I'm always struck. I've got the 2018 people on the phone, you know, to me inviting you to this event and meet Gary Lineker and blah, blah, blah. Does this stuff actually matter? Or is it just about convincing 12 of the 22 EXCO members? Patty?
Well, I suppose it does matter in that the more of a sort of head of steam is built up, the more perception. I mean, the one thing you do notice is that the word travels instantly across the world now. You know, somebody can say something in London and within 10 minutes the pipsqueak Warner over in Trinidad is giving his view on it. And vice versa, it must be said. So pipsqueaks like me criticizing Warner for his reactions. So I mean, it's very much an international village, and I can't help I'm counting the minutes till we get the accursed thing over and done with on Thursday.
Ollie, you make an interesting point today that. You know, there's going to be a lot of fallout if England fail to win, but that there's also going to be a sense that, oh, it was impossible because we're not like that. We don't go and bribe officials, and that's what you need to do. And this view that, this really negative view that pervades everything, that everything is sort of bent and corrupt, and unless you go and do favors and get your hands dirty, you won't win anything. To what degree do you buy into that?
I think we'll have to wait and see on Thursday. I mean,
What does that mean? That if England don't win, then it's corrupt?
Then it's corrupt.
England, no, but...
If Qatar win, then it's...
Well, let's say if Qatar win, and I am going to differ with your pronunciation of it, so excuse the inconsistency.
Colonialist, there, too.
Yeah, exactly. If Qatar actually win the thing... I mean, why would you vote for Qatar? I just do not see it as a place where any right-minded person, apart from Paddy, would advocate having a World Cup. We've just had the technical reports, the evaluation reports back from there. They're pretty much awful in terms of in terms of an awful lot of the categories regarded as high risk, etc. I don't think it's somewhere that is ready to hold a World Cup, and maybe never will be. I went there 12 months ago. I thought it was a joyless, soulless place, which is the last place on earth I would like to have a World Cup. And if, I mean, we gather that at least 8 people will vote for Qatar because they've already decided to do so, because they're in bed with Spain. And that, to me, sounds like people are voting for the wrong reasons.
Ollie, so am I right? I mean, if I can maybe sum up your point and tell me if I get this wrong, that, you know, there's 4 nations bidding for 2018, there's 5 nations bidding for 2022. Of those 9 nations who are bidding, there's some of them which are plausible, like Spain and Portugal, or like England, I would take. Mm-hmm. There are some which you consider to be implausible, and so, ergo, if they win, then something a bit screwy must be going on. Is that fair? Is that accurate?
I'd say that's a reasonable appraisal of what I say. I don't see any reasons why people will vote for Qatar apart from perhaps. No, let's be careful there. I struggle to see the reasons why people would vote for Qatar. I think Paddy has a different view of Qatar than I do, having been there last week. But for me, if those technical reports are so wildly contradicted by the decisions of people to vote for what look like strategic reasons at best to take the World Cup to Qatar, then yeah, I think the process is
but
is
you know
very
you've
dubious.
Got to be very very sorry
no,
can
no,
I just make a
no, go yeah, ahead, go ahead.
But there's obviously a suspicion of collusion between Spain and Qatar, which you know calculated towards making them the victors of each separate race. However, the word collusion's chucked around an awful lot.
Chucked in this case being an appropriate
precisely
term.
Because I was about to talk about Mr. Blazer, who is in total collusion, permanent collusion, from what you read in the paper. In this morning's Times, for example, there's an excellent article by Alec McGivern, who ran the England 2006 bid, which works on the assumption which we all work on, that Warner has Blazer's vote in his pocket. Now, if that isn't collusion...
Just if I can interject, this was the 2006 bid that found it appropriate to make a deal with Germany over 1996 and then screw them over, and I use the term screw them over, and try to steal the 2006 World Cup from Germany
To be fair, that was denied, although it is true.
But yes, this is the kind of individual that you're describing.
Exactly. And so, in other words, this permanent institutionalized collusion in with the likes of Warner. So I mean, you know, to feign shock at what Qatar and Spain are, in my opinion, perfectly legitimately doing, is, I think, a little ersatz.
Graham, can I throw something at you, which is that we try to sort of divine what FIFA and what Blatter are going to do and so on, but ultimately there seems to be so much contradiction there, because what I see from a distance is a lot of people say, I don't like joint bids, and FIFA supposedly don't like joint bids. If you're not going to have joint bids ever again, I got news for you. Your country will never, ever, ever host a World Cup. And in fact, there's only maybe 30 countries in the world who could host a World Cup.
Absolutely. I don't think Scotland can harbour any illusions about hosting a World Cup other than in a joint way with a country like England, and even then Scotland would be very much the poor relation of the bid. I mean, as a Scotsman, I can quite happily say I think it would be fantastic for England to host the World Cup in 2018 or anywhere else. In terms of atmosphere and stadiums and crowds, I can't see why it would fail. But the one factor here that does go against England is probably, we live in a climate of open self-criticism in this country, and therefore you get things like Panorama happening, which some people think may harm the bid. Now, I quite like that impressive self-criticism, but that is one difference between the way the England bid is something the England bid is having to put up with, and it may be something that plays into the hands of people like Jack Warner and other people who are not at all overly warm towards the FA or to Great Britain.
Yes, I'm very proud of the Sunday Times' journalism, and very ashamed of people like Jack Warner.
Well, I'm
proud to be a part of the British press, and not very often, but at the moment I am, and ashamed that football is run in the obviously corrupt way that the Sunday Times proved.
And at risk of contradicting my earlier stance on referees, I think one thing that should be transparent is the voting for this.
Absolutely.
World Cup,
what could be more appropriate
on Thursday? I mean,
what could be more appropriate?
That it's secretive. I mean, why should it be secretive?
Is it perhaps not a slightly more of a protection against corruption that it is that it is a secret ballot? Because if let's pretend that Paddy here I just want to put this scenario.
I will
get
tell
it.
Why
yeah. You can both tell me. Let's pretend Paddy is a bent, dubious EXCO member, I can pay Paddy $1 million to back my bid, and then producer Skinner over here goes and does the same thing, and Graham does the same thing. He collects money from all of them, and then he votes for whoever he likes, and then he comes back to me and says, "Ha ha! You know, I voted. Oh, I supported you. It's not my fault. It's a secret ballot."
That's why there is a secret ballot.
Right? Wouldn't have
because
an open ballot make it even more corrupt?
Apart from the Sunday Times, the greatest danger of disclosure is a briber scorned. Basically, that's where they fear that the whistle would be blown.
So we can have all sorts of scorned bribers here.
And if you had an open vote, it would be more of a guarantee of obviously it would be more transparency, but there would be less bribery if there was an open public vote.
Why would there be less? But you would have the same amount
because
of bribery, but you wouldn't have people coming forward and complaining they played bribes and got nothing in return,
Yes, exactly. That's the whistleblowing that they fear. In other words, we paid this person £1 million and he voted the other way. As indeed McGivern's article makes clear this morning, and this morning's time is common practice.
On that note, if we just go around the table and we'll do this sort of Academy Award style, in other words, will win, should win, for so I'm going to say 2018, and you'll tell me will win X, should win Y, and then I say 2022, will win X, should win. Paddy Barclay, 2018.
2018 should be England. I fear it will be Russia, which isn't even a football country. In 2022, I would be very happy to see another World Cup go to the United States.
And who will win?
Qatar.
Graham.
2018 should be England, probably will be Spain, Portugal. 2022 should be Australia, and I think will be Australia.
Ollie?
2018 should be England, or failing that, Spain. Will be Russia, partly because Spain seem to have played their cards wrong in their campaign. 2022 should be the United States, will be the United States.
Thank you to all my guests today, Patty Barkley, Ollie Kay, and from north of the border, Graham Spears. We're going to be back next Monday with another podcast. In the meantime, you can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis, and also our web chats. I do mine on Mondays. Ollie's is on Wednesdays. Patty, yours is?
Tuesdays.
There you go. You can also follow us on Twitter. I'm on there. Ollie's on there. Patty's on there, too, very rarely. Thanks so much for all your time, and we'll catch you on the other side.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.